the headlines this hour. Israeli settlers attack Palestinian homes, businesses, and cars in the occupied West Bank town of Huwara, injuring at least three people. South Korea says North appears to have fired two cruise missiles in what would be Pyongyang's fifth weapons test this month. And Mali demands that Denmark immediately withdraw its troops from the Sahel country days after a similar call for an end to the French military intervention there. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Another incident of violence in the occupied West Bank, with Israeli settlers injuring three Palestinians and vandalizing the properties near Nablus. A group of settlers arrived in the town of Huwara in a convoy of cars. They then began throwing stones at Palestinian vehicles, stores, and homes. All of that happening in full view of the military forces present there. Israel has been using settler violence as a strategy to take over the occupied West Bank and expel Palestinians from the lands that they own. Most of the time, military forces either stand by as observers or assist the assailants. Our correspondent Ramallah Morakandil tells us more about how this latest instance of settler violence unfolded. Let's have a listen.
The Israeli military claims that a group of settlers were celebrating marking the release of an Israeli settler who was accused for attacking Palestinians last year. Palestinians last year, of course, in the village of Huwara near Nablus. This is according to the Israeli military. And the convoy passed by the Huwara checkpoint at the entrance to Nablus city. But what happened exactly is a group of settlers attacking Palestinians, Palestinian vehicles, traveling to Nablus and other areas, passing by the Huwara checkpoint. And we are speaking about at least three Palestinians were wounded as the Israeli settlers hurled the stones at the vehicles and attacked them. Of course, Israeli military are always there. They are stationed at the military checkpoint of Huwara. However, they didn't do anything. They were watching the settlers' attacks of the Palestinians. And it's not the first time. But if it was a Palestinian or a group of Palestinians attacking Israeli settlers, or even coming close to Israeli settlers to speak to any of them, just without doing anything, immediately the result would be Israeli forces using their guns to open fire and kill Palestinians simply.
Hundreds of Palestinians attend a funeral procession for a man who died from tear gas inhalation hours after an Israeli raid on Qalandia refugee camp north of Al-Quds. 57-year-old Fahmi Hamad was one of the three Palestinians hospitalized after the raid. They were injured during clashes that erupted between Israeli forces and Palestinians trying to defend the camp. Regime troopers frequently storm Palestinian neighborhoods in the occupied territories. They often use live fire and tear gas to crack down on any acts of protest. Many of these raids turn out deadly. Iran's top security official rules out the possibility of direct contacts with the United States during the ongoing talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 accord known as the JCPOA. Ali Shamkhani says that Iran and the U.S. have been in contact in Vienna through what he calls non-papers. He believes such an informal way of communication is enough and that there is no need to go beyond that. Shamkhani, however, says that Iran will consider other options only if a good agreement is within reach to bring the JCPOA back to life. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal have been in talks in the Austrian capital since April of last year. The aim is to get the U.S. sanctions on Iran removed before Washington rejoins the deal.
Iran and the remaining signatories of the 2015 agreement that promised sanctions relief for certain caps on Iran's nuclear program are intensifying the process of drafting a revived deal. Delegates from Iran, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, and the EU have now adopted a new format for discussions, meeting together in one room to focus on the Iranian demands for verified and effective removal of US sanctions and guarantees Washington will not withdraw from the agreement in future or reimpose sanctions. This while expert-level talks continue in other rooms on Iranian nuclear commitments and the sequencing of steps that need to be taken for Iran and the US to go back to full compliance. European and American officials have been raising concerns about the amount of time left to reach a conclusion, with some diplomats suggesting they only have weeks, and other sources citing early February as an unofficial deadline.
If Western countries give the necessary assurances, the necessary guarantees, and if they remove the sanctions, then that will be enough. But if they want to drag their feet, if they want to be slow about it, then the negotiations will be slow. For Iran, that is the issue. Dates, the length of the negotiations, whether it takes a week or a month or a year, that's irrelevant. Because the Iranians know if they get a bad deal, there's nothing that they're going to be able to do about it. So they have to make sure that the Europeans and the Americans are unable to cheat them at the negotiating table.
Sources close to the talks say the negotiations are progressing at a normal pace. To claim that the talks have stagnated is unfair, they say, because resolving the outstanding issues requires further discussions given the complexities of the problems. Omar Lezgi, Vienna.
South Korea says the North has conducted another weapons test, firing projectiles into the sea off its east coast. South Korea's military says its northern neighbor has fired two suspected cruise missiles. This is North Korea's fifth missile test in the past weeks. South Korea, Japan, and the United States have been reacting with concern. Washington even imposed a set of fresh sanctions on the country recently, which Pyongyang described as an act of provocation. North Korea says its recent missile tests are an exercise of its right to self-defense in the face of potential regional threats. It is concerned about the American military presence in the South and their massive joint drills. South Korean arms manufacturers recently signed the country's largest ever single export deal with the United Arab Emirates for a missile defense system. But some South Korean activists worry about the deal's impact on the conflict in Yemen, as well as South Korea's efforts to attract support for peace on the Korean Peninsula. A correspondent, Frank Smith, reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in returned from visits to the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt Saturday. In Dubai, South Korean companies inked the country's largest ever single-arm sale, a reported $3.5 billion missile defense system for the UAE. Some South Korean activists worry about the human cost.
South Korea's decision to export weapons rather than trying to help to peacefully resolve the conflict raises a voice of concern over the export because it generates further tension, conflict, and division in the region.
South Korea has also increased weapons exports to Saudi Arabia. South Korea has steadily increased its arms development over the past two decades and now ranks as the world's sixth leading weapons exporter. South Korean companies have also diversified their offerings to include tanks, missiles, and even controversial cluster bombs. Saudi Arabia has deployed South Korea's Raybolt anti-tank guided missile to Yemen, where the conflict features more advanced weapons. Riyadh's recent airstrikes generated mass demonstrations there, but little interest in South Korea. Activist Chung worries how arms exports will affect diplomacy.
The government, media, and the South Korean people need to reflect about on how our appeals for support for peace on the Korean Peninsula will be considered when South Korea is increasing weapons exports under the rationale of profit and income.
President Moon Jae-in's trip comes as his single term is set to wrap up in May. However, South Korea's arms industry enjoys broad bipartisan political support. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Mali's military government is urging Denmark to immediately pull out its troops that were recently deployed in the African country. The junta says the deployment was undertaken without the government's permission and without the consideration of the protocol applicable to European partners. Last week, a group of nearly 100 Danish special forces arrived in Mali to join a European task force led by France. The force was launched in 2020 with the aim of protecting civilians against terrorist groups in eastern Mali. But the junta, which came to power the same year, has had strained relations with France, and has been calling for the withdrawal of his troops stationed there for nearly 9 years. We're going to talk to Julius Maluto, who's a political analyst who joins us from London about this. Julius Maluto, welcome. Let's take a look at this latest development coming on this, which is the fact that you have Danish forces that have landed in Mali. And the government says that this is done without their consent. And from what I'm understanding, this is a task force that perhaps under that umbrella they came through, which has to deal with the task force that maybe you can explain to us what they're doing there anyways, the Takuba Task Force. But how can it be that a government doesn't have knowledge and then for Danish forces to not get the permission from the government to land in Mali?
There are two important times in this crisis in Sahel region. We see 2014, the formation of what they call G5 Sahel countries. And this is Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. Ideally, these five countries were supposed to be the ones leading with troops in combating this terrorism activity. They were to be backed by what we call the Sahel Alliance, and this was launched, I think, in 2017 by France, and that meant it was to bring help in terms of finance and technical assistance from European Union, including German and European Union. So if that was the setup, then you want to argue that, number one, we shouldn't be having debates about French troops on ground in Mali. It should be maybe a question of empowering these five African countries, because it's their region, it's in their interest. They know their terrain better than any other person, and they have the troops. And therefore, if it was war against terror, being, you know, the EU helping, led by France, then we want to see technical assistance, not troops happening. And again, this particular one from Denmark, if you're talking about troops from Denmark, then arriving in Mali and the Malian government not being aware, I would not be surprised if Mali, government in Mali, of course, is military, but them being worried about it. Because, you know, when you're a Malian government and came to power, all these illegitimate ways, definitely you have to be, you know, standing on your toes, being very defensive and being looking around, who is doing what, could I be taken by surprise? And therefore, this element of this 100 men from German causing this current crisis we have right now. Speaking from an African perspective, we have seen economic interest being backed by military presence. I'll give you an example. If you look at the map of Africa today, it's awash with what we call military bases across Africa. And whether it's China having a military base on the ground in Djibouti, or American military having their military base in Djibouti, most of these, when you look into what are they there for, they're there to, look after the interests of the countries of origin. So therefore, when you see a military base from China, is there because they want to look after Chinese interest, investments, and everything that's happening there. When you go to West Africa, most of the time, even before independence of any country, what attracted the colonial masters to be there initially were the resources in those countries.
Okay.
And those resources are key debate even as we speak.
Thank you. Julius Maluto, who's a political analyst, who joins us from London about this. Thanks for tuning in. Tensions running high in Eastern Europe as NATO continues its military buildup amid a dispute with Russia over Ukraine. Spain's defense minister now says the warships and fighter jets it deployed in the region are not offensive. Margarita Robles says the missions are solely meant for deterrence. Other NATO members are also sending forces and equipment to Eastern Europe. The alliance says this is part of a plan to defend allies in the area. The United States also has 8,500 troops on alert as part of NATO's quick response force in case Russia invades Ukraine. Moscow has built up troops near the border with Ukraine, but it denies any hostile intention. It says it's concerned about NATO's eastward expansion. The Kremlin is seeking binding security guarantees from the alliance, including a ban on Ukraine's NATO membership.
On Monday, ministers from the EU's 27 member states gathered in Brussels to discuss growing tensions with Russia. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken joined them via video link. The West warns the toughest ever financial sanctions against Moscow will be unveiled if Ukraine is invaded.
It will be a quick and determined action with a strong unity, not only within the European Union, but also internationally.
Moscow accuses the West of unnecessary provocation. This as the US ponders deploying thousands of troops and military hardware to Eastern Europe. Many security analysts say the Kremlin is fully justified in demanding that NATO halts its expansion around Russia. There's concern that if a new sanctions package is unveiled, Moscow could turn off the EU's essential gas supplies. Also on Monday, the EU announced €1.2 billion to support Ukraine.
This package will help Ukraine now to address its financing needs due to the conflict. We count on the Council and the European Parliament to adopt this emergency macrofinancial assistance as soon as possible.
Von der Leyen says a further €6 billion is in the pipeline for Kiev. This is in addition to the €17 billion already sent by the EU to Ukraine since 2014. Critics are incensed because the bloc's own agency, the European Court of Auditors, says Ukraine is extremely corrupt. Negotiations between the West and Russia will continue at various political levels in the coming days. Analysts say the only option is for both sides to give ground, because the alternative is unthinkable. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from Leather's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
In the important event related to the Ghohar Shad Mosque, the leaders were the late Haj Agha Hussein Qumi, may God bestow paradise on him, and the scholars in Mashhad. In the 30th of Tir Uprising, the leader was the late Ayatollah Kashani, and in the 15th of Khordad Uprising, the leader was our magnanimous Imam and a number of other great religious scholars. In all of these events, a courageous revolutionary political cleric was present, and it was his presence that was the foundation of a popular movement. Of course, some influential people may have been able to make a certain number of people respond to something and urge them to make a move, but moving the majority of the people forward and creating waves in a great ocean has only been something a religious scholar or cleric could do. It is based on this that we can understand the secret behind the enmity of the arrogant powers in the world towards religious scholars, political religion, political jurisprudence, and political intellectuals. Their enmity originates from the fact that such people were anti-arrogant and anti-colonialist, and they were the initiators behind these great events.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The enemies were aware of this, and that is why they are opposed to the political scholars, political religious authorities, and political jurisprudence. They explicitly say that they are hostile towards political religion and political Islam. This is a reality that we should pay attention to. Moreover, the deep enmity and grudge the US holds towards the Islamic Republic of Iran can be understood from this matter as well. The Islamic Republic is the embodiment of the people's religious beliefs, and it originates from a revolutionary religious outlook towards the current issues in the world and in the country. Hence, the leader of the arrogant powers, the US, is opposed to the Islamic Republic. Some people say, "Why are you opposed to the US? Why do you say death to America?" In my opinion, this is a naive, shallow comment. The essence of the matter is that the nature of arrogance is such that it is opposed to a phenomenon called the Islamic Republic, which is completely indebted to religion and which originates from a religious movement and from religious scholars. This is one point about the 9th of January.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
For the first time, the Pentagon has declassified and publicly released footage of the U.S. drone strike in Kabul that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. It was one of the U.S. military's final acts in Afghanistan before ending its 20-year-long military intervention in the country. The videos show the scene of the strike before, during, and after a missile struck a civilian car in a courtyard on August 29th in Kabul. Indistinct images show individuals moving in or near the attack zone. The Pentagon initially defended the attack, claiming it had targeted an operative of Daesh terrorist group. But in November, the Pentagon acknowledged it had committed a tragic mistake. Instead of terminating a terrorist, the U.S. military had killed a civilian and 9 members of his family. 3 months later, the department announced no one would be held accountable for the brutal carnage. Critics believe such reports fail to address the systematic problems in U.S. conduct of drone warfare, making future civilian casualties inevitable. Now, many Afghans, including the victims' relatives, want the Kabul strike to be regarded as a war crime. Afghans say the U.S. military had acknowledged such strikes as mistakes in the past, but their perpetrators were never brought to justice. Based on the U.S. military's own assertion, Washington has conducted almost 100,000 drone and airstrikes in the West Asia region in the past 20 years. The U.S. is also guilty of civilian killings in many war theaters, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, from drone strikes to other military action. Rights groups have also accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them.
Now, if you're talking about rules of war, the traditional understanding of the just war, the Geneva Conventions, any of these things, you cannot deliberately target a civilian population. That's a war crime if you do that. But it became the tradition because of World War II. And because the United States won World War II, then they could establish this as a kind of right.
Despite the shambolic withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, the Biden administration has said it will continue to use aerial attacks, including drone raids, to deal with security threats in the country and counter Daesh terrorists. However, the killing of innocent civilians in Kabul raised questions about the future of U.S. drone attacks in Afghanistan. Now, advocates have decried the U.S. administration's stated plan. The Afghan-American advocacy group Afghans for a Better Tomorrow has urged an end to all U.S. drone strikes in the country, saying it's a failed policy that harms lives, destroys villages, and only allows for more violence to exist in Afghanistan. That's while the U.S. has a history of conducting similar strikes in Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan out of the spotlight without accepting any responsibility while destroying the lives of civilians. According to a new analysis published by the civilian harm monitoring group Air Wars, the U.S. strikes have killed at least 22,000 civilians across various theaters since 2001. The group says the number could probably be as high as 48,000.
The strategy of attacking civilians was established then. It's immoral. It's clearly immoral, but they've been doing it for 70 years now. And where do you draw the line? How do you say, oh, beginning in 1972, it became immoral? No, it's the whole tradition of air warfare is by its the way it's been executed here has been immoral from the beginning.
The high number of civilian casualties in U.S. airstrikes in various theaters calls under question the authenticity of Washington's claims of fighting terrorists and its intelligence precision. In late December, leaked Pentagon documents show that the U.S. air wars in West Asia have been marked by flawed intelligence, faulty targeting, years of civilian deaths, and scant accountability. This has further fueled the criticism of the Biden administration's Afghanistan policy and chaotic withdrawal of American troops from the country after two decades of war.
Iran, Russia, and China began joint military drills in the north of the Indian Ocean on Friday. Dubbed the 2022 Marine Security Belt, the exercises are the third to have been carried out between the three countries. The drills cover 17,000 square kilometers of ocean. Vessels and equipment from both Iran's army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps were on maneuvers. A variety of tactical exercises, such as rescuing burning vessels, releasing hijacked vessels, shooting at specific targets, shooting at air targets at night, and other tactical and operational exercises were carried out during the drills. Strengthening the security of the international maritime trade, combating piracy and maritime terrorism, exchanging intelligence in the field of maritime rescue missions, and exchanging operational and technical experience were among the objectives of the 2022 Marine Security Belt exercise.
I believe that the message is mostly to the people and to the nation, like the United States or other allies, that they want to have, they want to carry on some kind of activities in these areas. And if you ask me if this one is something where it will create a kind of joint action between Iran, Russia, and China, I would say yes, in this area. I don't think that they will tolerate in the future any kind of activities that we can define as terrorist or attack or pirates or these kind of things.
Iran says its presence in the international coalitions manifests the improvement of the Islamic Republic's standing in the world. An Iranian spokesman for the joint drills says Tehran attaches great importance to the establishment of security at regional and international levels. The trilateral exercises come as Iran is taking steps to balance its foreign policy. While talks on the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, and the removal of U.S. sanctions against Iran are underway in the Austrian capital, Vienna, Tehran is expanding its ties with its two key allies, Russia and China. Earlier this month, Iran and China began the implementation of much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact, known as the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership, a 25-year cooperation agreement that's aimed at strengthening the two countries' economic and political ties. Also last week, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Tehran and Moscow are set to begin working on drawing up a similar roadmap that will shape their cooperation for the next two decades. The statement came as Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi was on a two-day trip to Russia. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization's unanimous decision last September to approve Iran's membership to the bloc after almost 15 years was yet another development signaling the future of Iran's economic and political ties with the East.
I think that the strategy of the geopolitics of the United States is in this area, and I will say basically in Eurasia, is in the way that they don't want the formation of a strong Eurasian continent. So, they're fighting basically against China and very strong against Russia, and they have first the sanction with Iran, and they put a lot of pressure to Iran. So it's normal that these three countries, they will join together from a different point of view.
What this all shows is that Iran's seeking a more balanced foreign policy and that Tehran isn't staking its future entirely on the fate of the 2015 deal anymore. While making efforts to salvage the deal, it's considering other options to ensure its economic goals are met.
On Monday, Yemen's military launched retaliatory attacks deep inside the United Arab Emirates using drones and missiles to strike strategic targets in the UAE. Yemeni forces targeted a strategic oil facility and a fire at Abu Dhabi's international airport. The Yemeni military conducts regular retaliatory attacks against targets in Saudi Arabia over its devastating war on Yemen. But attacks against the UAE, which is fighting alongside Saudi Arabia, has been rare. It's widely believed that the attacks made UAE officials realize their vulnerabilities. The attacks are the greatest damage to the reputation of the UAE because they have always portrayed themselves as a safe and secure country to do business. Yemeni officials have warned they could target more facilities in the UAE. The years-long war on Yemen has killed tens of thousands of people and pushed the country towards humanitarian catastrophe. Following the retaliatory strikes, Israel offered security and intelligence support to the United Arab Emirates. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said the regime is committed to working closely with the UAE against Yemeni forces. He also ordered the Israeli establishment to provide their counterparts in the UAE with any assistance. Since joining the Saudi-led coalition in the invasion of Yemen, the UAE has focused on the southern and coastal regions of Yemen. It's also trying to take control of its strategic and resource-rich ports and islands in that region. Socotra is strategically located at the mouth of the Gulf of Aden, overlooking the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which connects the Red Sea to both the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. The UAE is annexing the island with the help of the Israeli regime. The UAE is said to be setting up an espionage center for Israel at the Socotra airport in Yemen.
This is not the case. Israel has no business interfering in Yemen any more than Saudi Arabia or the United States do, or the UAE. But by this recent action, which is the people of Yemen simply defending their country and opposing one of the other countries that is causing significant, just extreme problems within Yemen.
Al Hilal Emirates Company is said to have signed a contract with Israel to build a spy and intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at the airport in the city of Hadibo, the center of the Socotra Island. In December of 2021, Bennett became the first leader of the Israeli regime to visit the Persian Gulf state, more than a year after the two sides agreed to establish formal relations under a U.S. brokered deal.
Israel would like to see this as a false flag, would like to convince the United States government and the people of the United States that it must attack Iran because Iran has attacked one of its allies and poses a threat to the existence of Israel. Anything that anyone says or does Israel doesn't like, it considers what it calls an existential threat to Israel.
The UAE officially inaugurated its embassy in Israel in July last year, and then Israel opened its embassy in the Emirati capital in late June. Since they signed a normalization agreement in August last year, Israel and the UAE have signed a raft of deals in various areas, ranging from tourism to aviation and financial services.
Look to the east, the current Iranian administration says that is the policy it is implementing. Tehran prioritizes expanding ties with neighboring and other regional countries. This largely forms the basis of Iran's foreign policy and its deepening ties with eastern powers like China and Russia. The Iranian president's high-profile two-day visit to Russia this week has been widely described as a turning point in relations between Tehran and Moscow. Ebrahim Raisi, who arrived in the Russian capital on Wednesday, sat down for talks with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. The two presidents' discussions lasted 3 hours. Bilateral cooperation in the fields of infrastructure, energy, banking, and trade was the main focus of the talks. Putin praised the two neighbors' close cooperation on the international stage. The two presidents tasked Russian and Iranian foreign ministers to work out a roadmap for cooperation over the next 2 decades. President Raisi said the two neighbors will soon finalize their 20-year comprehensive cooperation agreement. During their meeting on Wednesday, Putin and Raisi condemned unilateralism and stressed the need to confront it. The meeting came as both Iran and Russia are locked in disputes with the United States, which both Tehran and Moscow have condemned for unending unilateralism. Tehran has been targeted by many rounds of unilateral American sanctions, and Russia, already under American sanctions over the situation in Ukraine, is now being threatened again by Washington as tensions over Ukraine run high.
Both Russia and Iran are being subject to the same kind of pressures coming out of Washington by the Biden administration, which is trying to reassert the U.S. hegemony over world politics. They're living in the past. The past is long gone past them by, but they haven't realized it yet, and they're trying to use the power of the so-called Western Alliance, which today is very much divided in many respects, to pressure countries like Russia, like Iran, like China.
In an address to Russia's lower house of parliament, Duma, on Thursday, the Iranian president said sanctions are a common form of bullying and domination. He added that fighting the sanctions requires a collective response and cooperation among independent nations. Some observers believe that American sanctions have persuaded targeted nations like Iran, Russia, and China to work together more closely. Meanwhile, Raisi also warned that the United States has forged a satanic alliance with the terrorists. He said complicated plans are afoot now to send the terrorists on a new mission to the Caucasus in Central Asia. Russia and Iran have a history of cooperation in the fight against terrorism in the region, especially in Syria. And observers believe they could act together again if necessary. The Islamic Republic seems to be very serious about its look to the East policy. Becoming a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in September last year is considered a major step in that direction. Also, Iran and China's 25-year strategic cooperation agreement, which the two sides began implementing a few days ago, is another major sign that Tehran wants to enhance relations and exchanges with Asian powers.
That's really where the future is. You're going to see probably a revival of what used to be the ancient Silk Road now with China's Belt and Road Initiative, which now Iran's going to be a part of. And that may, again, put that whole region in the center of economic development to the demise or the lower position by the Europeans and the Americans.
Iran says it is open to more partnerships that benefit both sides and are based on mutual respect.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, fertility prevention. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the fertility prevention according to the Islamic lifestyle. Now, when we talk about the fertility prevention, we can see that in many families, in today's world, generally, not just about the Muslims, and we talk about the non-Muslims as well, the rate or ratio of abortion is being increased in the girls. And this is something alarming. This is not natural. And this abortion has its own results upon the mother, who is the mother, and obviously the next generation, and on the society. And therefore, we need to stop this thing from happening. This is the duty of doctors. This is the duty of governments to stop, to make this illegal. But unless it has been proved by a doctor that it is necessary to save the life of that person or the girl or the mother. And if it's not in order to save the life of mother, then they should not allow them to do such an act. Why? Because this action itself has many wrong results. It results in many dangerous things in the life of a person, which you can just study. Obviously, you can see that over the internet. There are many things which are written about this, but still, we can see the ratio is increasing, and this is a really alarming situation. And Islam is against such thing. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of fertility prevention. And we talked about the abortion that we can see that the ratio of abortion is increasing. Now, why abortion has been basically forbidden in the Islam, except in the special cases, it is because, obviously, when a child is being created or it's in the womb of the mother, there is a life in it. And this life is of a child, although the child is not completed, but obviously he has a life. This child who have a life is a living thing. So therefore, if someone does abortion, it's equal to killing that child. And therefore, we can see that it is said that وَلَا تَقْتُلُوا أَوْلَادَكُمْ, do not kill your children with any reason that you have. And here, obviously, we can see that in this reference, when we look at the Quranic verses, we see that Allah says, do not kill your children, do not kill them. Why? وَلَا تَقْتُلُوا أَوْلَادَكُمْ خَشْيَةَ إِمْلَاقٍ, do not kill them because of having fear of, you know, having nothing or the being poor. نَحْنُ نَرْزُقُهُمْ, we give them the rizq. It is Allah. We do not feed the kids. Yes, it takes its feed from the mother when it's in the womb. But this system, the whole system has been created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And therefore, he wants this child to basically be born. And it is said, even if there are two people who have unlawful relation or through adultery, a woman has become pregnant, she cannot have abortion. She needs to wait until the child is born. And this child do not have any, sin. There is no sin upon this child because it was the action of his parents. So therefore, Islam stops from anything that stops that causing, the stopping the next generation to be born. And Islam stands against this action. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام القلب مصحف البصر.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "The heart is the book of the eye."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, we find in the historical texts of the Muslims, and we find in the historical texts also of the Shias and the Sunnis, that the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam was truly a universal persona. His persona encompassed all different aspects of life, and he was the manifestation of a complete human being, an insani kamil, a perfect human being, a complete human being. It's interesting, but a lot of the things that we learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, are from his behaviors and his actions, as well as his seerah, his sunnah, and the traditions that we have from him, the sayings that we have from His Eminence Imam Ali alayhi salam. And it's really interesting that even though these statements were said over 1,000 years ago, 1,000 years into the future, we find that these statements are very much applicable to every single one of us in one way or the other. Now, sometimes we, as a human being, are looking for something which is called Adama. So Adama is also one of its forms is Azim, right? We say great, magnanimous, magnificent. It is one of the names of Allah, Azim. And so here Imam Ali says, one who is fond of Adama, one who is fond of magnanimity, one who is fond of magnificence, is one who never goes after sin. It's so beautiful, right? We sometimes think that if we want to be magnificent and we want to have magnanimity and we want to have this trait and this attribute of Adama, that we need to be proud or arrogant, or we need to put down other people or humiliate or oppress other people, you know, or we need to have a lot of money, a lot of wealth, we need to have a great social status, right? Or we need to have a great political power, a great political position. And it is supposedly these things in our frail minds that we consider to be azim, to have this adama, to have this magnificence, this being sublime and great and awesome. But here Imam Ali alayhi salam, he seems to turn the tables on every single one of us. He says that the one who is azim, the one who has adama, the one who has magnificence, is one who does not go after sin. And truly it is a beautiful statement, and it is a true statement. For the one who does not sin, the one who does not break the commandments of Allah, the one who refrains from the things that Allah has prohibited, the haram things, and likewise the one who goes ahead and does the wajibat, the things that are obligatory, because to not do the things that are obligatory is also considered a sin. And so one who continues to strive in doing the wajibat, in doing the obligatory things, and one who refrains from sin overall, that is truly a person who is magnificent in the eyes of Allah. And so, if you want to be magnificent in the eyes of Allah, and you want to be magnanimous, and you want to have magnanimity, then as Imam Ali alayhi salam says, do not go after sin. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
أسعد حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
وقتی شخصیت امیرالمومنین رو بشناسه در مقابل او خضوع میکند.